they recorded.
Okay. What I want to do today is I want to give you a sense of what are Rishonim, what are Achronim, what is Parshanut HaTalmud. It's not something we usually talk about, methodology, history, but it's important to be able to make order in terms of how things, people relate to each other, how things relate to each other, who quotes whom, and then that will ultimately morph into the question of authority. Some of what we're going to talk about next few weeks I talked about it last year to the Chutznikim, from the North American Chutznikim, so you can supplement whatever I have to say with three shiurim that are on Yahrut Torah called Ashkenaz, the differences between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, something like that. However, we're going to look at things from something of a different angle, so that I'm not repeating the same shiurim. First of all, in terms of defining you're learning how to conceptualize and define terms. We talk about Rishonim, we talk about Achronim. The Gemara, when it talks about Rishonim and Achronim, it's always relative. For example, on the one hand, there is sort of, a certain tension between the statements about Rishonim and Achronim that do appear in Shas. On the one hand, you have the famous statement in the Gemara in Yuma, that im rishonim kam alachim anu bnei adam, im rishonim kam bnei adam anu kechamorim vafilo kechamoru shel Pinchas ben Yair. That if the earlier authorities were like angels, we are simply humans, and if they were like humans, we're like donkeys, and we're not even as good as the donkey of Reb Pinchas ben Yair, who was something of a remarkable personality in the time of the Tanaim. That's on the one hand. That kind of attitude betokens a very clear sense of deterioration of the generations. I mean, the earlier ones were angels or people, and we're profoundly different than they are. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have a Gemara in your Rosh Hashanah, Dav Yud Zayin, that says that cannot be paralytic. You can't let that get to you, because it's usher actually to say that, well, we can't do anything, we can't say anything, or to reject the contemporary rabbinic leadership because you're not Moshe Rabbeinu, you're not this one, you're not that one. The Gemara quotes a pasuk in Kohelet to say that's a very, very stupid thing to do. Ella yiftach bedaro kishmuel bedaro. Whatever you got, that's what there is. Yiftach bedaro kishmuel bedaro. If you're saddled with the yiftach as your leader, then you have to make the best of it. If you have Shmuel, even better. Interestingly, built into that statement, however, is an assumption that things can get better because Shmuel lived after Yiftach. So the two actually come from different angles. According to the first statement I quoted, there's sort of a Giridata Dorot. There's a decline of the generations. According to the second statement, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, you have more of a, you know, actually things can get, you have to deal with what you've got. But by the same token, things could actually get better. Interestingly, I was at Bris yesterday, and they named the kid Yiftach Shmuel. And it didn't occur to me. I mean, I don't know what the Yiftach was from. I know the Shmuel. Shmuel was named after the grandfather. But it was like, after I got home, I said, oh my God. Like, why did they do that? They want the kid to be like a Yiftach? Or they want, God forbid. Or they want it to be like a Shmuel. It's like not clear. And anyways, so that's where the terms come in. We use the terms, okay, as for chronological purposes to be able to delineate periods in Torah and Talmudic creativity. For our purposes, and we'll see in a minute why that is, for our purposes, Rishonim, the period of the Rishonim starts around the 8th century, sometime late 7th, early 8th, next 6th, I mean, within the period of the Muslim conquest. And it ends, now here's a point of contention between me and all this farm. There are books that give all these sort of handbooks of various principles of halachic decision making. One of the most famous ones is called the Yad Malachi, who will tell you, you know, this one, and when this one disagrees with this one, you should paskin like this one, all kinds of other little handy, they're called heuristics, sort of rules, the handy rules that come into play. And the Yad Malachi will tell you, if you look, that the period of the last of the Rishonim was Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he was also the first of the Achronim. So everybody between the early 16th century is a Rishon, And after that is achronim. What's a nafkamina? Nafkamina is whether you're allowed to disagree, whether you're allowed to disagree or not. In other words, if you're an achron is generally within the same period of halachic creativity, you're allowed to disagree. Even later generations and disagree with earlier generations, which is an interesting, relates to my earlier comments. But once you pass into a new era, there's sort of a general consensus that one does not, at least except in extraordinary circumstances, disagree with somebody earlier. So hence, for whatever the reason is, and I don't want to go into it right now, Tanayim disagree with Tanayim, but Amorayim don't disagree with Tanayim unless they find the Tana de Misayeya, unless they find that they're representing another legitimate Tanaitic opinion in a Brisa, in a Mishnah, or whatever the case might be. And as a result, they're just continuing an earlier argument, but not saying, I disagree with all the Tanaim and have my own opinion. Occasionally you find the exception to that rule. Rav, for example, they always say Rav Tanahu Palig, because Rav straddled the era of the Tanaim. He was both a Tana and an Amora, so he gets to play both sides of the fence. And there are other exceptions. He's not the only one. But generally speaking, once you enter into a new era, you're not allowed to disagree with, when we don't disagree with the earlier era, unless you're basing yourself upon the, works of a person in that earlier era. Same thing with regard now. Once we get to the 6th century or so, of the Common Era, with the sealing of the Talmud, alright, at that point you're not allowed to disagree with the Gemara. The Gemara becomes, we'll talk about it in a minute, how that happens, it becomes the ratified constitution of rabbinic law forever and ever. The commentaries on the Gemara, which we'll talk about why that happens, the first era are generally known as the Rishonim. It's subdivided into Geonim and Rishonim. What's the difference? Because for the first chunk of time, from around the 8th century until, traditionally we say the Geonim ended 1038 with the death of Rav Hai Gaon, the center of gravity of Torah learning was in Iraq, was in Babylonia, in the city of Baghdad, or Baghdad as it's more properly pronounced, that's why it's G-H-D-A-D, because it's not a G, Baghdad. There you had the two yeshivot of Surah and Pumbedita, which had transferred from sounds of that, you can have Hebron and Yerushalayim, and Vichin B'nai Brak, and Slobodkin B'nai, whatever you want. The heads of those yeshivot were known as Roshe Yeshivot Ge'akov. The head of the yeshiva, which is the pride of Jacob, and the heads of the yeshiva were called Geonim. Some of them were Geonim, and some of them weren't such Geonim. But the yeshivas themselves were the center of study, and that period is called the period of the Geonim. From the 10th century on, the center of gravity shifts westward. We'll talk about this more next time. Shifts westward. The Geonate goes into decline. It doesn't disappear, but it goes into decline. And the center of Jewish, of rabbinic and halachic creativity shifts to three places in the West. One is Spain. Second is Provence. Provence is southern France. And Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz is northern France, western and west central Germany, and for a little bit England. Because the Gaonim headed up the institutions from which the Talmud Bavli emerged, there is some discussion among Rishonim whether the Gaonim have a sort of a special status or not. We'll see in a minute how that plays out. In any case, the period of the Rishonim, we haven't decided what they do yet, but the period of this first stage of Talmudic creativity, now, as I said, ends in the 16th century according to the traditional Sifrei HaKlalim, the traditional historical periodization. I think it happened before that. I emphatically believe that the period of the Rishonim ends in Ashkenaz. It ends in the first half of the 14th century after the Black Death, and in Spain it ends at the first half of the first quarter of the 15th century. As we go on, you'll see why I think so. The Nafkamina still is the same. Nafkamina is, if you are classified as being a Rishon, then you are allowed to disagree with Rishonim. If you are clad, if you are an Achron, even if you're lesser of a person, or if you're, you know, if you live afterwards, it doesn't matter. If you're an Achron already, then you will never disagree with a Rishon or come up with an opinion which is totally off the wall, totally new, without any support from the words of the Rishonim. Okay? Within the era of the Achronim, that's the big fight today. The era of the Achronim, who's allowed to have an opinion? So, it's interesting in that regard, that yes, everybody's accepted the Shulchan Aruch, but when Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, started writing, so he disagrees on many occasions with serious Achronic heavyweights. I mean, like the Notab Yehuda, like the Chassam Sofer, like all kinds of other people. And he got it on the head. There was a Satmar rabbi who wrote a very vicious polemic against Rav Moshe, called the books of Rav Moshe Feinstein, called the Igros Moshe, the Letters of Moshe. And this guy, this Rabbi Schwartz, was a rabbi in Queens, New York, wrote a polemic against Rav Moshe, saying, who are you to disagree with this one, and this one? The name of the book was Ma'ane La'igaros, the answer to reply to the letters. And Rav Moshe said, I don't see any problem. This is Gach Darkei Shem Torah within a specific era, you can make up your own mind. I wouldn't disagree with Rishonim, because that's not part of the deal. But within a specific era, you have more flexibility as long as you make a cogent halachic case. There was a question. Yes?
Is this all based on the statement there in Yoma?
It's not based on the statement there in Yoma. In terms of that, in terms of Yerushalayim Achronim, we defer to the Rishonim. There is something of that. Although I will argue when we get there that it's more than just the sentiment. Basically, I think what ended up happening was it was really a sea change. Everything that really could have been said by the Rishonim had been said, and things went off on a different tack. But let's wait for that. Okay.
The Vilna Gaon and the
Metzir. Thank you for mentioning. So the Vilna Gaon is the exception. The Netziv somewhat less. The Vilna Gaon is the exception. The Vilna Gaon decided that the bottom line is the Gemara. We'll see that in a minute, and that he can play. He's a Rishon. He can do whatever, you know, whatever. And in fact, I tell you that the Grow is a Rishon. How does a guy who lived in the 18th century become a Rishon when he lives between either 200, or as I argue, 400 years after the period of the Rishonim? Because the Grubs, he had that authority and he had that intuitive breadth and depth and whatever that he could. I mean, the Grub, for example, I'll give you an example. The Grub corrected printed texts of everything under the sun, every book in the Torah library. And one of the sforim was in really terrible shape was Masechta Shkalim, which is the Yerushalmi in general is in bad shape. Masechta Shkalim, and he went through and he went based on his own logic, his own insight, his own lexical intuition. He made all kinds of emendations to make the Masechta make sense. Years later, after he died, 100 years after he died, the Geniza, the Cairo Geniza was discovered. You know what the Cairo Geniza is? Okay, the Cairo Geniza was discovered. They found vast passages, you know, whole sections of Masechta Shkalim. You know what Geniza is. So the Geniza, it was a, well, you know what a Geniza is, right? That's when you take Sefer Kodesh and stuff that are no longer useful, and instead of, if you don't bury them, you put them in a box and they sort of disintegrate by themselves. So in Egypt, there was a Geniza in the Ben Ezra synagogue, which contained basically everything that people had found in Hebrew that was no longer useful, and just chucked it up there. And it turns out when it was discovered by Shlomo Salman Shech, it was actually discovered by two little old ladies from England, but he figured out what it was, discovered by Salman Shech in the 1890s, it turned out to be a treasure trove of everything in the world. Old Gemaras and manuscripts, autographed manuscripts of the Rambam and manuscript letters of Yehuda Levi and the full collections of poetry of people of Yehuda Levi and Tshuvas and Tshuvas of the Gaonim and the Bill of Sale. There's a scholar's name is Shlomo Fritz Goitein, who reconstructed the entire economic life of the Jews in the 11th century based on bills of sale and stuff like that he found, and Ksubas that he found in the Geniza. And the collections are just so massive that we still haven't really gone through everything that there is. It's really incredible. Anyway, so when they found, among the things they found in the Geniza was passages from Shkalim and Masechet Shkalim. And it turns out that the Gra in his emendation was right on the money based on his intuitive assumption what the text should have been, turns out that that's exactly what it was. But that, so that's the grub. So the grub's a lot. The grub's a different. The grub's a different different ballgame. Okay. What I want. So let's. So that being. And so we are now in the era of the late Achronim, if that's what you want to call it. They talk about the classical Achronim, the late Achronim. We're, whatever the case may be, we're in the post Shulchan Aruch era. People discuss it that way. But in any case, so you're talking about, so the first, there were a series of watersheds. I want to talk about the watershed between Talmud and Rishonim first. And then next week we'll start talking about how Rishonim work. Yes. Yeah, I know. I know a Rosh Hashiva calls our generation the Tatonim. I don't know if he knows Hebrew well enough to know what that means. But you could say that. Look, it's... It's a difficult call. Yes, when you learn the writings of the Rabbi Yehuda and the Gra and some cipher, I mean, you get blown away and say, well, who do we have on that kind of stature? On the other hand, as I said, Reb Moshe, I mean, you have to be Barachi, I mean, you have to know how to read Hebrew, things you have to know how to do. But Reb Moshe didn't think that was, the Kachdarka Shel Torah. There is a sort of like balance of reverence and autonomy, which sort of characterizes before Shem and Poskim throughout the generations. I'll give you an example. In different every generation has different perception. I'll give you two examples that which are not necessarily representative, but just happen to pop into my head at the moment. On the one hand, you're all familiar with Reb Usher Weiss. You've been exposed to Reb Usher Weiss. So Reb Usher Weiss is a phenomenon. He's a phenomenal Talmud Chacham. He's a Dayan. He's a Magid Shir. You can go hear him in English. You can go hear him in Hebrew. He's around. He gives a Shir, I think, three times a week, four times a week, and twice a week at least. Once in Beit Vegan, and once in the Chachanover base. Not Chachanover. Chachanover? The Chachanover based Medrash in Ramot. Anyways, so he knows everything. He knows everything by heart. He gives off the whole thing, but he gives these really organized shiurim without notes. So, on one occasion, he rejected a tshuva of Reb Moshe because Reb Moshe disagrees with the Mishnah Berurah. And he didn't understand how Reb Moshe could disagree with the Mishnah Berurah. Very difficult. That's his position. I mean, there is that. On the other hand, because the Mishnah Berurah was older than Reb Moshe. On the other hand, without bringing politics into it, one of the more interesting parts of the current conversion controversy in Israel is the fact that contemporary rabbis are blithely. I mean, you want to have a principled position, fine, but blithely belittling a position that which underlies the more lenient, if you want to say it, call it, approach to conversion, which is based on a tshuva of Reb Chaim Ezer Grodzinski and his Shutach Yezer. You have to understand that before the war, if whatever Reb Chaim Ezer said, that was the law. That was it. Finished. No, nobody did anything. If he said no is no. If he said yes is yes, goodbye. He was al piv yishak kolami, at least the Lithuanian world, and this whole Geras thing partly is based on a really blithe bittle of Reb Chaim Ezer. In fact, I remember when we had a situation a few years ago when a certain Dayan in the Beit Din of Rabban Elyon ex post facto annulled something like 25,000 conversions that were done by the governmental conversion authority, and without going into the case itself, and one of the people who went to protest that action was Ravon Lichtenstein came, and I remember, never forget, as long as I live, he got up there, and most of his remarks were about who are they to dismiss an explicit position, Reb Chaim Ezer. So you have different, there are the deferential and the non-deferential position that coexist. It's not all of a, it's not all of a piece. Now, even when you reject, when you disagree, you should do it with modesty and whatever sense. You know, so-and-so's opinion is difficult to understand, then you'll give your alternative. But that doesn't, you know, you're not allowed to be mevaze if you disagree. Unless you're in like the unless you're in the mega leagues, I mean, you know, I remember more than once hearing the Rav give shot and saying, "This is what Tosfos says," and nevertheless, I am correct. And I remember like wanting to fall off my chair, right? But that, you know, when you're a gon, they, I guess you have a certain they play by different rules. Okay.
In any event,
I want to take a look at the. But in general, I'll put it this way. There was a constant tension between autonomy and real Yirat Shamayim and deference towards the Gedolim of the past. That is a constant moment in Talmud Torah in general and Pesach Halacha in particular. And different poskim will take a different position on the scale. Some will be more autonomous, and some will be more deferential and work accordingly. So it really varies. Okay. I want to talk about the first, in order to understand Parshanut Talmud, you have to understand what happened in terms of the Gemara. Up until the time of Ravina and Ravashi, sometime in the late 5th, early 6th century. Okay? Everything, it's going to sound odd that you guys should say this, but have to say this, all Talmud Torah was oral. Okay, I remember I said this to a yeshiva Shabbat class that I gave in the States in some institution, and they start screaming that I'm not Bikiris and this and that. I can say they didn't have books, but it's called Torah Shabbat Peh. Why do you think it's called that? I mean, anyway, you don't think about these things. It was all oral, number one. Number two, it was an ongoing process. Okay? It was an ongoing process on the one hand of passing on the traditional teachings of earlier generations, adding on to them, expanding them, analyzing them, and interestingly, within the context of the Gemara, very frequently, the later opinion is the one that's more accepted. Okay, so for example, we have a din, that after the mid-4th century, at the time of Abaye v'Rava and Rava in Babylonia, we Davka prefer the later opinions to the earlier opinions within the frame of, you know, the Gemara. The Gemara discusses Mishnah Rishona, Mishnah Achrona. Okay? Mishnah Rishona, Mishnah Achrona. Then we usually prefer Mishnah and Mishnah Achrona. Later Amorayim, we go like, Ravashi spends his time disagreeing with all kinds of great earlier Amorayim, because you're all within the same framework, and it's an ongoing development of Torah Shebaal Peh. Okay, until you get to the late fifth, early sixth century. We'd like to say 500, 550, something like that. All right, that is expressed in a statement in Gemara Bav Metzia. Take a look at passage number one. Bav Metzia Daf Pei Vav and Aleph. Rebbe v'Reb Nosson Sof Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Reb Nosson together mark the end of the period of the Tanaim. They redacted the Mishnah and put it into the form it exists in today. It wasn't written at the time, but it was a book nonetheless. All right. After that, all learning became organized around studying the Mishnah as the base text, although it goes off in all kinds of new directions. Okay. And Ravina, Ravashi, v'Ravina, Sof Hora'ah. With the end of the careers of Ravina and Ravashi, you get to the end of Sof Hora'ah. What does that mean? So look in Rashi. Sof HaMishnah, meaning Sof HaTanaim, the end of the era of the Tanaim, Ad Yimeihem Amru Ishet Varav Bevet HaMidrash. Everybody got up and said what they had to say. Vayu Talmidim Gorsim Shmua Shmua Levada. And each student would sit there and memorize by heart each specific din or each specific tradition. Velo ayu mesechtos duros, and everything was sort of mixed up. There were no organization into, you know, whatever it is, you know, brachos, sepeya, ma'asusheni, trumas, shabbos, erevin, ksubas, yumas, whatever it was. Veseder, v'kibetz ala seder. And comes Rebbe, together with Reb Nosson, and made and organized everything. All the truth of the matter is there are indications Rebbe Akiva started the process before. V'hem kalalu ha'amur b'dorot shelifneihem. And they organized, included everything that had been said in previous generations. V'sidru et ha'masechtos. And they organized the various tractates. V'achareihem lo yosifu elamad. And after they finished, very little was added afterwards. We have a few Mishnayos where... We have a few Mishnayos where it's children of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and the generation immediately afterwards add here and there a comment, but fundamentally, you know, overwhelmingly, the Mishnah, the end of the Mishnah is sealed, not to be changed, with the activity, with the publication of the Mishnah of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. The one great exception to this is, of course, the end of Uktzin. There's a statement by Rabbi Shubin Levi. Shubin Levi was a Bechlala, an Amora of the first generation. So the question is, why is he there? So a friend of mine once argued that the reason is because that's at the end of Shas. If it comes to Shema Shas, everybody wants to get in the party. But that's just a joke. Anyways, point is that Tanaim are, that with the end of the Mishnah. So at that point, the Mishnah becomes the binding, ratified statement, summary of Torah Shebal Peh. Brisos are used to elaborate, to elucidate, to supplement, and so on and so forth, but the priority of Mishnayos is definitely a given. Okay, that's as far as Sof Mishnah is concerned. Sof Horah, says Rashi, knows Rashi is uncharacteristically long here, which is really quite remarkable. It just tells you how important this is as far as he's concerned. Sof kol ha-moraim. Ad yemeyem lo aita gemara la seder. It says almost the exact same formulation. The gemara was not organized. They had these long transcripts of people of discussion. What's the gemara? It's long transcripts of discussions of everything under the sun, every mission under the sun, it was all floating around. Okay? Elaksha, and people knew the stuff by heart. Think about it, you know, and the truth is, how can you know all the stuff by heart? They train their minds to remember. But beyond that, if you consider all of the junk that we walk around in our heads, then there'd be a lot. If we didn't use it for that, then we could use our gray matter for other stuff. You know, I mean, you know, one good movie takes up, you know, 2 gigabytes on a hard drive. That's a chunk of change. You think of what you know what? Let me put it this way. I have a flash drive, all right, this is 16 gigabytes, rather, okay? Everything I've written, because words take up less room, in the past 30 years, okay, maybe more, takes up, like, maybe the bottom line of this thing, okay? If I added movies, five movies fill the whole thing. So you gotta figure out what you're using your gray matter for. In any event, they knew everything by heart. Somebody would learn a Mishnah, they ask, what is this price? What is this Mishnah about? Or somebody can do it about a case. Is there a case with regard to X, Y, and Z? You have plenty of places. How Gavrida did X, Y, and Z, right? Call echad ve'echad omer tamal, and everybody would get in the action. They discuss it, and they bring in all kinds of other discussions, and so on and so forth. Ravashi v'Ravina sidru shmuos amarayim l'shufneim. They collected everything from all the batei medrash and from all the yeshivas, and they organized it according to the Mishnayos. That's why, by the way, one of the reasons why you have the same sugi appears in 2 different places because it relates to two different Mishnayos and so on. It's a massive job. Okay, v'kavu al seder amasechtos kol echad ve'echad etzal mishnah haruyah b'shnuyala, and v'hikshu kushiyot sheish lahashiv, and they asked all the questions that had to be asked. Uperukim shiruyim letareitz, and the responses of the solutions that were appropriate to offer v'amorayim shemahem, and also together with all of the various side opinions that came up. V'kavu akol b'gemara. And they all organized it into this thing called the Gemara, which is the ultimate parish on the Mishnah. Even though especially the way that the Gemaras are printed, the Mishnah is sort of swallowed up whole by the text of the Gemara. Kigon Esve Mesve Raminu Boyalu Vatairutsim Shalayem Umashi Hirushishiru Tamil Shalifnayem Votan Shamru Lifnayem Akusha Vatairutsim Shalayem Lokvo Megamaral Seder Masechtot Shasida Rebbe Ubal Ravashi Ravina Klob. So Ravina Ravashi organized everything. The word kava in Hebrew means to set, to establish, and it really also means to, that's it. Done. Okay? So according to Rashi, Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora'a means that there was a fundament that something changed. That from now on, the totality of discussion of Torah Shebaal Peh is no longer going to be a matter of I'm participating in a dialogue with the people of the past as an equal participant, but now we are faced with a book, which has now become canonized, and has become, if it's as if it would become the canonized constitution of Rabbinic Judaism. Okay? The person who noted this, we'll come to the reason how that happened and how that was achieved, okay? The person who noticed is actually the Gra. Look at, you see, I have the Rif there, the Rambam, and now the Shulchan Aruch. Kol Dayan, this is a famous, this is probably the most famous, for Psak Halacha is one of the most important simonim in Shulchan Aruch, if not the most important. Kol Dayan Shedan Dini Mominus V'ta'a. Dayan comes and makes a mistake in a civil case, and he made a mistake. Im Ta'a B'dvarim Agluyim V'yiduim. If he made an often a mistake, it's something that everybody knows. It's obvious. Kigon dini ma mufurashim ba mishnah or ba gemara or b'divrei haposkim choser hadin v'danino tahalacha. He makes such a blatant error that his verdict has no standing whatsoever. You start from scratch. Says the Ramah, mihu yeshomrim dim nira ledayin v'levnei doro mikoch rayot muchrachot she'ein hadin kamoshus karba poskim yachol lachlok alav. However, if a dayan comes upon an accepted position among the poskim, after, okay, and they're absolutely convinced that he can prove that they're wrong, he can disagree. Okay? Me'achar, says the Ramah, me'achar she'eino nizkar b'gemara. Since that, if it's a case which is not mentioned explicitly in the Gemara, says the Gra, why? Oh, I didn't bring the Gra. Oh, all right. Why, says the Gra, because Ravina Ravashi Sof Hora'ah. The Gemara has been canonized. You can't disagree with the Gemara. Can't disagree with the Gemara. That's it. It's not just a question of legal procedure, however. Up until the closing of the Gemara in around the late 5th, early 6th century, okay, you could actually, everybody who was part of the Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh was part of an ongoing conversation on a level playing field, more or less. With the publication of the Gemara, which still isn't written yet, but still, alright, you're no longer carrying on a dialogue directly with the Amoraim and the Tanoim. You are now interpreting a book. Okay? You follow the difference? So now, it's not a question of, instead of carrying on an oral conversation, now I am engaging with a sefer, with a corpus of law, which I have to understand, interpret, and then apply. So that what happens is, the process of Torah Shebaal Peh goes from being a combination of understanding the words of the earlier generations and adding to them on the same playing field, to accepting the authority, the total authority of the Gemara as an entire integrated whole. And now my job is to learn Gemara, understand it, and then to whatever's inside it, apply. And I am no longer under any circumstances allowed to disagree with open and clear decisions the Gemara provides. And B, I'm also not allowed to, anything I say has got to ultimately pass muster with what the material and discussions found in the Gemara itself. Now, so I can't come up with, even though I might be convinced, and we generally say, Mahalacha kerav bisure, halacha shmo bedini, that in civil cases we pass them like shmo, and in ritual cases we pass them like rav. Once that rule's there, Forget it. I could be a Shmuel person from today till tomorrow, unless I can prove from the Gemara itself that the overwhelming majority of the Talmudic tradition goes against Rav in a case of Isser V'Hetter. I have no standing, because it's a close. The Gemara now presents you with a closed universe where everything with which everything has to pass muster. So now, all of my efforts are going to be to try to understand the words. Keep in mind, okay, that at the same time, almost at the exact same time, within 100 years at least, the world is conquered by the Muslims. Aramaic is no longer a spoken language, and you don't understand what the words mean anymore either. Okay, you forget the people who speak Aramaic. One of the most. Anybody see the movie Shakespeare in Love? Gwyneth Paltrow soon to become Jewish? No. Okay, so one of the things about Shakespeare in Love is the fact that all of the dialogue, the entire script is written in Elizabethan English. And that's like, it's something people get used to because they don't realize that, so we were all used to Shakespearean English and there has to be footnotes to explain what the words mean. But there was a time people spoke like that and they didn't need to have like flowing subtitles over the place. The same thing over here. There was a time when you didn't have to explain the Aramaic words in the Gemara to a person. But within 100 years you had to, because Arabic swept the field and took away and swept Aramaic away largely. And certainly, with the exception of one scholar who thinks differently, and certainly Jews are living in France and Spain and Italy, France and Germany and Italy, they didn't speak Aramaic on a regular basis.
Which year was the transition?
What? Transition starts with the Muslim conquest, but keep in mind, by the way, it takes time for the Gemara to spread. Just because it's in Babylonia, it doesn't start spreading. Books travel slowly, so it doesn't spread. So the Gemara only first comes to Italy in the 9th century, and it only comes to Germany in the early 10th century, maybe late 9th century. It only comes to Spain in the late 8th, early 9th century. People, you know, it takes time for it to spread, and by the time it starts to spread outside, people don't speak Aramaic anymore. That's the easiest way to explain it, although the scholars would disagree with me. Okay. So you go from participating to studying. You understand the difference? Clear? Yes, you had a question.
Sorry, you said there were two things that changed. One, we're no longer allowed to disagree with that decision.
Because we're no longer part of that world. Something has changed. There's the sea change. We're living in a different era. Yes.
And the second one was that anything that I want to say has to fit within
the... Because it becomes sort of like the Constitution. Correct. You can have, okay. Something which
the Gemara...
Even if you come up with something totally off the wall that's not mentioned in the Gemara explicitly, you have to muster precedent or something from the Gemara. It becomes the touchstone of halachic truth. Period. Notice, you know, and even so. So there, if you have proof, you can argue the proof, not that. That's what the Rama is talking about. Well, I'll bring a raya from the Gemara. It says, okay, fine, maybe it doesn't work, maybe it's not good, whatever, you can think so. But if it's explicit in the Gemara, if it's like, then there's nothing you can do about it. That's it. Finished. I would admit, what?
When a minhag starts up all of a sudden,
okay, this is an interesting point. There is a difference of opinion as to what the source of the authority of Minhagim is. The general Sephardic position has been that Minhagim really ultimately are legislated. In other words, the Minhagim, most of the Minhagim, not Minhagim that you have to have, I don't know, Kreplach on Erev Yom Kippur and on Sukkot Torah. I mean, you know, Minhagim, do you stand during Kris Torah or not? How do you do a wedding? You know, stuff like that. That most Minhagim that have halachic valence, were ultimately ordained or legislated or passed muster with rabbis in advance. And therefore we're automatically vetted, as it were, in terms of the Talmudic tradition. The Ashkenazic position is a little more nuanced. The Ashkenazic position, this is one tradition among Ashkenazim, that the Jewish people has something of a sixth sense, something of a residual prophetic capacity, which allows it to sort of create Minhagim on its own, but they still have to somehow pass muster with the Gemara somehow or some not. Okay? That's another whole direction. Okay. I will mention, by the way, that this question of, again, I'm not polemicizing, but I will, it's important to realize that the, one of the major points of dispute, at least in the early days, one of the major points of dispute between Orthodoxy and conservative in the United States was specifically over this question of Ravina Rashi B'Tzof Hora'ah. To this day, the conservative movement, Reform doesn't care because they by definition don't subscribe to, don't see the Talmud as a source of authority. But the conservative movement ostensibly does. They do not accept this idea, and as far as they're concerned, contemporary rabbis can overturn anything the Gemara says if they feel that it's warranted. We, on the other hand, defer to tradition and say that Ravina Rashi wrote a Sof Hora'ah, and that the authority of the Tanaim of Merayim is sacrosanct. Okay. All right. The question is, how did the Bavli get, how do you authorize something like that? How do you ratify a book? How did it happen? So here you have actually two differences of opinion. The first opinion is found by the Rif. The Rif lived in most of his life in Fez, in North Africa. Towards the end of his life, he moved to the city of Lucena. It's a city in southern Spain, in Andalusia, which was the center of Jewish activity during the so-called Golden Age in Spain. There was no Golden Age in Spain, or at least it was maybe a Gilded Age in Spain, let's call it. It was golden in terms of Jewish creativity. It was not golden in terms of the Jewish status under Islam. But in any event, he moved to Lucena, which, by the way, was a city that was, at one point anyways, 100% Jewish. Major city, 100% Jewish. How do we know? Because at one stage in the 9th century, the Jews of Lucena sent a letter to Babylonia, which was still the center, the ultimate center of Jewish life, and asked, how do you make an Eruv for Shabbos in Lucena? So the question came back, the answer came back, that it's a sin, you just have to lock the gates, because there were no Goyim in Lucena who could create a problem of setting a unified Rishus for the city. And this is not a, sort of like it was a throwaway. He says, oh, this is the case, so yeah, it's a cinch. In any event, he moved to Lucena, which is where he died, I believe, in 1103. I forgot to look it up. The Rif, at the end of Erev, he wrote the first really complete code of Halakha, which is an abridgment of sorts of the Talmud. And he writes as follows. He quotes a machlokas, it's really not important what the issue is, machlokas Amoroyim, and machlokas Bavli Yerushalmi, and he says as follows, Va'anan lo svir lanachi. We don't accept the opinion of the Yerushalmi. The cave on the sugyan de Gemara de lan lahetera, since our Gemara, the Bavli, says explicitly that whatever, that the case is mutter, lo ichpas lan, we don't care, but my da asri be Gemara de mei ravav. We don't care about the Yerushalmi. Dal Gemara di lan samchinan, because we rely on our Gemara, de basrahu, because it was organized later than the Yerushalmi, about 100 years later. The inhu, though, in other words, the Merayim in Bavel, in the 100 years after the redaction or the completion or the sealing of the Yerushalmi, havu b'ki b'gemara de b'nei meravet v'eminan. They knew the traditions, and they knew the Gemara of Eretz Yisrael better than we do. V'ilav de kimlu, if they were not convinced, the high member de b'nei meravet, lav de samchu, if they had not been totally convinced that what the Yerushalmi's position was not authoritative, lo kashar le'inu, they wouldn't have allowed it. In other words, to put it differently, as far as the tradition base, we accepted the Bavli because it's a better book. It's more inclusive, it's more expansive. I mean, I'm going to add now. It's more authoritative because they were able to more critically evaluate everything that came before. It's more inclusive, has a broader vista, and therefore therefore we accept it. I will add that the Bavli is also, it covers more ground. You ever learn Yerushalmi? It's very difficult because it's not, it lacks the give and take. It lacks the style. It's extremely styptic of the Bavli. So the Bavli's a better book. In other words, so ultimately, sort of like a consensus that developed that we accept the Bavli. Now, the truth of the matter is, there was also a war that went on between the yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael and the yeshivas in Bavel as to whose book was going to win. This went on throughout the 8th century, late 8th, early 9th century. But in the end, the sentiment of the Rif in terms of the formality is, we sort of like, it was sort of an intuitive thing. We know what's good when we found it, and we accept it because it's, the Bavli has too many, has many, advantages. It's superior to the Rishalmi in many different ways. The Rambam is a more formal position. The Rambam in the Hakdama to the Mishnah Torah says, Nimtza Ravina Ravashi v'chavrehem sof gdolei chachmei Yisrael amatikim. It doesn't mean like copy like in a test. That means that they transfer. Okay? Because they weren't writing anything, don't forget, it's all Torah Shebal Peh. By the way, the Rambam, the desire to have Torah Shebal Peh, that keep as much as possible Torah Shebal Peh oral, is a very interesting thing. This sort of desire still exists. You have these massive, you know, learn all Mishnahs by heart, and I have a nephew actually, great nephew who won a prize in the Lubavitch Yeshiva in Lud because he memorized Gan Masechet Shabbos by heart, and there were yeshivas in the Middle Ages where all of the discussions in yeshivas were about books. Only the Rosh Yeshiva had a book, and everybody else had to know everything by heart. Knowledge by heart was always considered to be like the Rambam. The Rambam thought that you'd learn the Gantz Mishnah Torah by heart, and you would do Chazor every 30 days. You go through the whole Mishnah Torah. Same thing, by the way, in the Mechaber. The Mechaber thought that the Shulchan Aruch, I mean, he was talking about Shulchan Aruch, the pocketbook, not the Shulchan Aruch, takes up 9 volumes. Knowledge by heart was always considered to be still the preferred way. But anyways, that Ravina Rashi marked the end of those. They also undertook legislative activity. First of all, notice the Rambam in the when he discusses the legislative activity of Torah centers, he puts together takanot u'gzeirot, which we know are legislated together with what? What's the third thing? Minhagim, apropos what you said. So you see that he assumes that minhagim are legislated. Okay? V'achar beitin shel Ravashi shechiber agmara v'gamru v'gmaro b'mei beno nitpazru Yisrael b'kol ha'aratzot pizur yoter v'igiu l'ktzavot ha'yim. When they traveled out, there was no longer any center. So according to Rambam, basically, and this is what he hints at, and which I couldn't cite everything. But which a later authority, the Reb Moshe of Kusi, who basically copied Mishnah Torah almost wholesale, adds in much more detail. He said what the Rambam is describing here is as follows. The Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim describes how the Sanhedrin used to legislate laws for all of Klal Yisrael. So the first thing they would do is set up a committee. They set up a committee to test the thing to see if the proffered legislation is viable. To see if it's a gzera shirov tziburi cholim lamodba. Okay? Then, after they get the committee and the subcommittee, they'll bring in their reports, and then they make, and then the Sanhedrin, takes a vote, they pass the thing. It's still considered to be that piece of legislation is still suspended. It's obliged. It's obligatory. You have to do it. But it's not considered ultimately binding until it is, based on a Gemara and a Vodara, until it's ratified. It has to be ratified by a majority of the Jewish people who accept it. Okay? If it's Pashat Barav Yisrael or Bechol Yisrael, which means Kol Yisrael, then it's binding forever and ever and goodbye. If it doesn't spread, okay? If it doesn't spread, so it's not binding. Whether it needs to be abolished or not, or whether it just sort of falls, is a question. Okay? But I'll give you an example of a case where this comes out halacha lemaisa. How many times do you wash during the Seder? How many times? Twice. Okay? You say bracha both times? How come? How come you wash the first time? Oh, just know it's Kadesh Orchatz, right? Because there is a bit, because Chazal made a gzera, a takana, that you don't only just wash for bread, you wash for kol davar shetibula b'mashkeh. If you have food which has a sauce, or it has one of the seven mashkaot, which are, okay, I'll tell you the acronym is Yad Shachat Dam, you can work it out later, then it's things that are makabel tuma, then you have to wash before you eat the food. Okay, yes sir. Of those two takanas, the one about washing before bread took, the one about washing before you have a davash, which would mean any salad that you put, it's not totally dry, you put a dressing on, never mind everything else, that you don't have to, okay? Now, at the time that the Mishnah was written, the jury was still out apparently on this issue about the davar shetti below the mashkeh. So the Gemara says you have to wash, but we don't wash with a bracha because it wasn't accepted. Nobody washes. I mean, I know a few people who do it, but I mean, you know, only people that are really chassidim v'anei shemaisa, they wash for davar shetti below the mashkeh. You don't make a bracha, you wash. I have a friend actually who's I don't know if he still does, but I remember when we were chavrusas, he's Rosh Shiva Karim Yavne, he was always makbid to wash for davar shetti below the mashkeh. The Gra in Hilchos Pesach says no, you have to make a bracha, because as far as we know, Chazal never, the no Sanhedrin ever abolished the thing. It's still hanging there. That's enough to mean as to whether you need to have a second minion to abolish it. In any event, the Rambam uses the style that he uses to describe legislation to describe the process by which the Talmud was adopted. Pashat Barov Yisrael. The implication is, and this is explicitly stated by this Rabbi Moshe of Kusi in his Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, which he finished in 1247, about 80 years after the Rambam finished the Mishnah Torah. He says that there actually was this big rabbinic conclave, and everybody came, and they took a vote, and they all adopted, they all ratified the Gemara, and the Gemara is Poshet Barov Yisrael, which is the ultimate ratification. Two-thirds of the states to ratify an amendment, and then it becomes binding. So according to the Rif, it was a process of consensus, a gradual consensus. According to the Rambam, it was a formal act of ratification. Either way, it's irreversible. And at that point, and because by definition, you're not going to be able to, can't be overturned, therefore the Gemara becomes the litmus test, the touchstone of halachic truth. La'olam v'ed. Yes. The Shulchan Aruch, there was never any, the Shulchan Aruch is much, let me put it this way. The Shulchan Aruch does not have the same authority as the Gemara in this regard. The Nesivus says that Klal Yisrael accepted the authority of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah and the Shach and the Ta and so on, and just like in other situations. And it overwhelmingly that's true, but the possibility of disagreeing is greater. Although the truth of the matter is that the authority of the Mechaber and the authority of the Ramah is pretty sacrosanct. But it wasn't by formal enactment, it was more like the Rift describes and by the way, when you talk about the Shulchan Aruch, there are three Shulchan Aruchs. One Shulchan Aruch is this little hot pocketbook that was published by Rabbi Yosef Karo, was sort of like a monarch, you know what the monarch notes are? I don't know, in South Africa. What do you study for your, do you ever take exams to get into university? It's like a study guide. For his big work to base Yosef. That's Shulchan Aruch number one. Shulchan Aruch number two is that little study guide with an abridgment of his own work by Rabbi Yosef Karo, by Rabbi Moshe Isserlitz. Also, you can stick it in your pocket. Or put it on your smartphone for that matter. The third one is this book just keeps going with more and more meforshim, it keeps expanding. That's I think Shulchan Aruch creates a universe of discourse rather than being a bottom line. Okay, so I didn't get to even finish what we planned. Next week we'll talk about the Gaonim and for a little bit, and then we will talk about Rashi. Okay. Yep.